From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted today that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration. And with just 12 days until the end of his own presidency, calls for Trump to leave office right away are mounting. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Congress will proceed with impeachment if Trump doesn't leave office willingly. There have been talks about using the 25th Amendment as well. And in a video last night, Trump condemned the violence at the Capitol on Wednesday after his supporters stormed the building, but he did not accept responsibility for inciting that violence. He also promised an orderly transfer of power. Earlier, I spoke with Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, and I asked him whether Trump's message last night changed anything.
No. He's trying to paper over a disastrous incitement of only the second attack on the U.S. Capitol in American history, and to finally throw out some platitudes after it's all said and done. He's already torched the place. And if you just look, Tanya, just at the events of the last couple of weeks, his horrible mismanagement of the pandemic, when we're now experiencing unnecessary and unprecedented death, his foolish attempt to veto the defense bill that Congress overrode, his antics challenging the election, which frankly cost Republicans a Senate majority, and then the shameful incitement of the violent attack on the Capitol a couple of days ago. I mean, he is a guy who is just willing to trash the entire endeavor on the way out because he didn't get what he wanted. And a few platitudes that included in last night's statement does not obscure any of that.
We have just a few days until his presidency ends. What do you think should happen? Should the president be removed using the 25th Amendment?
I believe that's the appropriate thing. That can be done immediately. The vice president and cabinet can take that step. President Trump then has two choices. He can slink out of town with his tail between his legs, or if he wants to challenge the action, he can send a letter to Congress challenging the action, and then it becomes for Congress to vote and decide. And to uphold the removal, Congress would need to do it by a two-thirds vote in each chambers, which I think, unlike a year ago, you would likely get right now. But I think the cabinet and vice president should take that step. We have work to do in Congress as well. There needs to be some accountability for those who helped President Trump perpetrate the big lie about election results not being accurate. We obviously have to clean house and do some different things with respect to Capitol security. So there's a number of things that need to be done. But the most important one is, I think, we've got to end the Trump chapter after the disgrace of Wednesday.
Okay. So if the 25th Amendment, though, isn't invoked, is there really time for impeachment? And would you be worried at all that either of these avenues, the 25th Amendment or impeachment, would just make things worse as the clock runs down?
On your first one, just on the timing, I don't really think there's time for impeachment. The House says they may act next week, and I'm not going to spend too much time thinking about it unless or until they do, because the Senate has no role unless the House acts. So my focus right now, I think, is on helping prepare for a Biden administration that can start to repair all the damage that this president has done and then help us build out of the pandemic health and economic crisis.
Your colleague, Senator Chris Coons, says Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley should resign after challenging the Electoral College results in Congress this week. Do you think they should resign or be punished in any way?
I think a lot of us are grappling with what the accountability should be, because just, you know, to dig into it, it is so easy for a Josh Hawley from Missouri to say, you know what, I want to disenfranchise Pennsylvania voters. I'm going to object to Pennsylvania. He knows those voters can't hold him accountable. Ted Cruz, I want to object to Arizona voters. I want to disenfranchise all Arizonans. He knows they can't hold him accountable. And every last member of the Senate who voted for these objections, Tanya, they voted to disenfranchise voters in states other than their own. That is a complete chicken move. So there needs to be some accountability. Here's another thing. Both Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley were fundraising in the middle of the riot.
Share blame in what happened on Wednesday?
Absolutely. Absolutely, they share blame. And here's what they should do at a minimum. We need to contemplate censure and other steps, but at a minimum, trying to fundraise when senators were locked in a secure location because of the rioters that they helped incite, they should take all the money that they have raised into each of their campaign accounts since Election Day, when they've helped Donald Trump perpetrate the big lie, They should take every penny that they have raised and give it to the family of the Capitol police officer who died last night, who died after he was attacked by the mobs that they encouraged with their repeated lying about the election. If they do that, and if they apologize, then maybe we could contemplate whether a censure would still be necessary. But they should have to give all that money back. It's blood money, and they should give it to the family of this officer who was killed at the Capitol.
Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia. Senator, thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely.
Well, meanwhile, pictures of people who smashed windows, attacked police, and barged through the U.S. Capitol are all over the internet. And those people are starting to find themselves in legal trouble because of it. Femi Oke is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, tough times. Thanks for helping us make some sense of this.
Oh, you're welcome. This is really a story that's rooted in social. The protests were planned on social media. They were streamed on social media. And it looks like now that we may find the rioters on social media as well.
Yeah, so I guess you could call them citizen detectives. People on social media are kind of going through these pictures of the mob that stormed the building, and they're working on helping to identify them for the police. What exactly are you seeing?
It's a very enthusiastic sleuthing and tagging of the @FBI. And I just have to say, the FBI Twitter page is just for social media information. So if you go to the FBI Washington Field Twitter page, that's FBI WFO, they have posted their contact numbers, seeking information, wanted flyers, website details. So don't just tag @FBI. If you see somebody you know, you see somebody you recognize, go that one step further. Otherwise, that information will not get to the FBI. So what am I seeing? Some very detailed examination of social videos and social posts. So let me give you an example. John Scott Railton, he describes himself on his Twitter profile as chasing digital badness. He is looking at very extreme close-ups of the rioters. And he says things like, this man is carrying police-style zip-tie handcuffs and mace. Was there a plan to take hostages? And then another photograph goes in very, very closely to it. Screen grab, I should say. Another man with zip ties in the Senate spotted, feeling more and more like this was coordinated. He brings down a detailed breakdown of the clothes, a Tennessee thin blue line PVC patch. This is real detective work, putting together a picture of not only who the rioters were, but what did they have planned? Some companies have also been doing this. If they've seen their ID tags popping up in some of these videos and some of these screen grabs, and they've been firing people that they've been seeing who were in the Capitol building on Wednesday.
Well, you don't have to zoom in to recognize some of these people. West Virginia State Republican lawmaker Derek Evans live streamed himself entering the Capitol building. Let's listen.
Keep it moving, baby. The door's cracked. Yes! We're going in.
Easy,
easy, easy. They're in.
I mean, I have a hard time listening to that, to be honest with you. It's not a great idea to post a video of yourself committing a federal crime online. What have you noticed?
But this is the conundrum that was really difficult for many of us to understand, was that there was so much confidence in the rioters. They were live streaming, they were taking pictures, they were taking selfies. One alleged rioter posted a picture of her after the riot. She says, after storming the Capitol, a good glass of champagne is needed. That was tagged to the FBI. Elizabeth from Knoxville, Tennessee, went viral when a reporter talked to her. She was outside the Capitol building. She appeared to be crying. She said she'd been maced. And the reporter said, what were you doing in the Capitol building? She says, with great indignation, we're storming the Capitol. It's a revolution. That video is going all over Twitter because people were just amazed at her confidence. She gave her name. She was like, well, don't you know why we're here? But Jeff Twomey, he makes such a great point here. The dumbest thing with most of these people is they went into this with a live phone. Cell services will have records of phones in the area and times. Google Apps on 99% of the phones will have exact time, place, records, good to a few feet. That info is on Google and cell service. So the FBI, whether you're tagging them at FBI, you're going to their tip page, they have a lot of information that they're going to be pouring through, not just citizens detectives.
Just about a minute left here to go, Femi, but I do want to ask you about something completely different, something that happened to you recently when you were at a grocery store pharmacy. Mm. You got an unplanned, surprised COVID-19 vaccination. What happened?
I live in Washington, D.C., and I was in my local Safeway, and I heard this announcement. If any customers would like a COVID vaccine, please come to the pharmacy clinic. I thought I'd misheard. I went to the pharmacy clinic, and I was given part one after filling out all of shot number one, after filling out a lot of medical information, shot one of the Moderna vaccine. When I asked why, they said that in the grocery stores in Safeway and in Giant in Washington, D.C., they are having health care workers clinics, so they're giving them the vaccines. But they do not want to waste any vaccine shots. So if they have any vaccine shots, they have been given permission by DC, by the mayor, to give out those vaccine shots to anybody, anybody who's around who wants one.
Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks as always.
The news moves fast. Listen to the NPR News Now podcast to keep up. We update stories as they evolve every hour. So no matter when you listen, you get the news as close to live as possible on your schedule. Subscribe to or follow the NPR News Now podcast.
At least 82 people were arrested after that pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol on Wednesday, breaking windows, looting, and ransacking congressional offices. Who are these people? And were they acting on a message from President Trump at a rally before where he said, quote, we're going to have to fight and encourage people to walk to the Capitol? Oren Siegel joins us now via Skype to talk about this. He's director of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Oren, we're hearing a lot of claims about who was at the rally and this insurrection. And based on your research, who was there? And were there any specific extremist or hate groups that you follow?
Among those that we saw were the Proud Boys, which have been known for violence in the streets of D.C. over the past month. We saw some white supremacist groups like the New Jersey European Heritage Association, the neo-Nazi Nationalist Socialist Club. We also saw, you know, some militia types attending the event. But I think what's important to remember is as many of the actual extremists, there were many people who were motivated to carry out an extremist act, even if they weren't part of or viewed themselves as part of any of the groups I just mentioned.
Hmm. Have any of those groups responded to this widespread condemnation across the country of what happened on Wednesday?
Whether it's people who were there or those who just support them who didn't make it, there is this celebration of the violence that we saw. So, for example, for the Boogaloo types, you know, who want a civil war to start, they feel like what they have is the seminal moment that might kick it off. For accelerationists, these militant white supremacists who need for chaos to ensue in order for the, you know, white race to reestablish itself in this country, they also had a victory. So the point is, there's a lot of celebration of the violence that is happening by extremists in these online spaces.
Authorities are still searching for a lot of these folks, though, because they let them go on Wednesday. Mm. It shouldn't be too difficult to identify them, though, right? I mean, with all of these images and videos that are circulating, did you recognize any of the faces among the mobs?
So we've identified, you know, several of the individuals who not only were at the event, but also in the Capitol itself. But what is going to be a challenge, what makes this different, is again, these are not just sort of established extremist movements and their supporters that showed up. This is a pro-Trump extremist movement that was kicked off. Average Joes and Janes who showed up and who were incited to riot and in a sense became extremists on this day. Those people are not as easy to identify, at least for those of us who monitor extremism, but I have no doubt over time will be identified by law enforcement.
Well, as we know now, more than 24 hours after the looting and violence, President Trump condemned what happened on Wednesday and called it a heinous attack. He said he was outraged by the violence, lawlessness, and mayhem, but he did not mention that he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol, and he said, "We love you," to them as they stormed into the Capitol. How dangerous was this message in stoking this kind of extremist behavior, not only on Wednesday, but from this point moving forward?
I think what we have seen in Washington, D.C., at the Capitol, is the logical conclusion of leadership failing to condemn hatred, bigotry, and extremism. When it's allowed to flourish, when extremists feel emboldened because they are able to do what they want, when their messages are echoed by the champion in the highest office, all that does serve is to make them feel empowered. And so this is a reminder of why it's so critical to condemn constantly any messages that promote violence, any messages that promote conspiracy theories and disinformation.
We got news today that the inauguration later this month will go on as planned at the Capitol. Should we be concerned that these extremist groups are planning something similar on Inauguration Day?
Yeah, while it's unclear who might actually attend the inauguration, we know extremists are talking about it. We know that they view what happened just a few days ago as a precursor for what they hope will be taking it to the next level on January 20th. We don't know if indeed we will have extremists on January 20th, but we don't have a luxury to ignore that possibility. Anti-government groups, conspiracy theorists, white supremacists are all talking about finding a new time to continue what has started. Will it be January 20th? Maybe, maybe not. But one thing for sure, 2021 is going to be filled with additional flashpoints.
Oren Siegel is director of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in 2016, DeRay McKesson, a Black Lives Matter activist, was arrested in Baton Rouge, Louisiana during a demonstration. Police say he was ignoring an officer's request to get out of the road. McKesson recorded his arrest as it was happening, and a warning: what you're about to hear is a confrontation.
Look at the city police, you're under arrest.
What?
Don't fight me, don't fight me.
I'm under arrest, y'all.
Back up, I got y'all.
5 years later, McKesson is still dealing with the fallout from this arrest and that demonstration. The case has made its way up to the Supreme Court. And McKesson says his story is just another example of the differences in how people of color are treated by law enforcement. DeRay McKesson is now the co-founder of Campaign Zero, a nonprofit aimed at ending police violence, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you, DeRay. You know, before we talk about your own experience with police, what was going through your mind as you watched these mobs of people freely violating the U.S. Capitol this week?
It was sort of astonishing to think about how unprepared the police were for a planned action. It's not like people just like rolled up on the Capitol. They planned this, they announced it, and to later learn that there were only 500 officers available when there could have been 2,000 because the Capitol Police just chose not to plan for this. I've seen the police be more aggressive for 40 people than they were for the thousands of white supremacists that were on the Capitol. So it was surprising just to see how bold everybody was. The police not doing anything, the white supremacists putting their feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk. And you know what? People walked home. I thought I'd seen it all. And then there was that.
Well, let's talk about what you've seen in comparison to what we saw on Wednesday. You participated in many demonstrations around the country. Some interactions with police, I would guess, were good. Others, not so much. Can you describe in comparison for us how some police agencies interact with Black Lives Matter protesters, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that was consistent across the board is that they were really aggressive and that we were armed with the truth. And that was it. We didn't have weapons. We weren't shooting people. We weren't breaking things. Like, that wasn't the spirit of the protest. Yet, you know, we were maced and tear gassed and pepper sprayed and shot at. I have friends who lost their eyes. I have friends who got shot with bullets. And all we were doing was saying the police shouldn't kill people. These people were pushing the police, like literally physically pushing the police. You know, the officer who died eventually because he got hit while he was there. Like, those things are just so much more intense than anything that ever happened at a protest that Black people led.
Yeah. I mean, 2 days later, I think we're still very shocked and processing what we saw. You know, I mentioned your arrest in 2016. One of the Baton Rouge officers sued you. He was seriously injured by someone else during the demonstration, but he held you responsible because you organized the event. What do you want people to know in the context of what happened Wednesday, where people who violated the law were escorted out of the U.S. Capitol building by police instead of arresting them?
What was really shocking about my case to me, and having lived through it for 5 years, and we did win at the Supreme Court, but we're now at the Louisiana Supreme Court for another issue about the case, is that at no point in the 5 years was there ever a question about the facts. That the mere allegation from the police officer was enough to entangle me in litigation for 5 years, and I didn't do it. With white people, the living proof, like watching them do it in real time, still is not enough for there to be a consequence. If I hadn't seen it happen like everybody else did, I probably would think people were exaggerating. I'm like, no, somebody couldn't have broken into Nancy Pelosi's office and nothing. Like, it's so just out of the context that we think of.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you've been working for several years at police reform, and here is this mission statement from your organization, Campaign Zero. It reads, "We can live in a world where the police don't kill people by limiting police interventions, improving community interactions, and ensuring accountability." Do you see what happened Wednesday as an inflection point in getting to this aspirational world that you envision, where we can see the disparity in the way that people are treated?
I mean, you know, there have been enough things to happen where nothing has changed that I never get my hopes up high. I'm also reminded that, like, seeing is believing to a certain extent, but, like, we got to organize after this because, you know, just like the protests this summer, people are like, okay, I get it. They don't know what to do next. So then the question becomes, what do you do? How do you challenge the power of the police? How do you change a system so that it isn't as bad as it was before? And I think that's where organizers come in. We're working on a lot of stuff now. You know, the police kill 1,100 people a year. The police actually kill more people in 2020 than 2019. So for all of the good work of the protests, you know, the police were pretty unchanged last year. Like, it wasn't like there was a dip in their killings at all. So I think the next step is always, like, how do you change structures and systems? The good news is that the legislature is just open. There'll be a lot of legislation around the police being introduced. And this is our moment.
DeRay McKesson is an author, activist, and co-founder of Campaign Zero, a nonprofit aimed at ending police violence. DeRay, thank you so much.
Good to be here.
The U.S. economy slashed 140,000 jobs in December, marking the first monthly job loss in 8 months. Today's figures from the Labor Department just confirm what many economists had already predicted, that the long winter and rising coronavirus infections would deal another blow to the economic recovery. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, what did you see in that jobs report?
Well, Peter, it's sort of like a deja vu to what we saw in the spring. As you pointed out, you know, the COVID was flaring up. The cold weather meant more restaurants couldn't continue with outdoor dining and that type of thing. So that leisure and hospitality category, which includes bars and restaurant jobs, they lost almost 500,000 jobs in the month.
Wow.
And Peter, another area I think is important is government jobs. That category lost 45,000 jobs. And since February, government jobs have gone down by 1.3 million. So some of that's sort of distorted by the census jobs, but I do think it's a signal of how hard some state and local governments are struggling due to the loss of tax revenue because of all these businesses that have shut at least temporarily, if not permanently, Peter.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the restaurant jobs you mentioned. Those the restaurant industry was already hurting tremendously. Look, there was some talk that the arrival of the new vaccines would help pull us out of this hole. But as we all know, distribution has been very, very slow. Do you think that had an impact on this jobs report? And maybe even more importantly, do you think it will have an impact on the jobs recovery going forward?
Right. So for this report just covers December. So I don't think the vaccine developments really move the needle too much for the December report. But you're absolutely right about going forward for the first half of the year, at least perhaps the whole year, is that the rollout of the vaccine and how successful we're able to get people vaccinated, I think, will be one of the key metrics, if not the most important metrics, for getting the job market back to where it was.
Mike, stocks closed at record highs yesterday, which is pretty hard to believe considering the attack on Capitol Hill this week and the political chaos that we're living through. What do you make of that? Are investors living in reality right now?
I think you'll probably find plenty of people that will tell you no, they are not. But, you know, the market is what it is. And I think for now, the clarity around who would control the Senate after the Georgia elections, that removed a lot of uncertainty about sort of what stocks and what industries investors want to bet on. And I think with the prospects also of more government spending, coupled with everything the Federal Reserve is doing to stimulate the economy, and all this pent-up consumer demand and savings that is expected to be unleashed once we do get through the other end of the virus, that, for the moment at least, has people very gung-ho about the stock market. It is a very fickle beast, however, so let's talk about it again next week.
I'm sure we will. And speaking of government spending, we just have a little bit of time here. With Joe Biden in the White House and Democrats controlling the House and Senate, what do you think? Those $2,000 relief checks, will they be on their way?
Well, so the latest on that is from the Washington Post. They're saying that West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin is against the $2,000 checks. He's a Democrat, but he doesn't always vote that way. So I think that's still in the sort of category of possible, but not quite probable just yet.
Now, that's interesting because there may be some Republicans who support it, a few, but maybe just enough if it's a 50-50 tie in the Senate. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
Nearly 6 million Americans have now received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine, which still falls far short of the goal to vaccinate 20 million people by the end of 2020. In fact, some health departments have only received their first shipments of vaccine this week. That's 3 weeks after they were approved. Dr. Irina Gelman leads one of them. She's commissioner of the department in Orange County, New York. Dr. Gelman, I know you just got your first 800 doses of vaccine. Are you as surprised as I am that it took so long?
Yes, it was definitely surprising and a bit counterintuitive in terms of receiving the vaccine a few weeks after the original allocation.
Yeah, so what did you try to do to speed up the shipment? I mean, did you tell anyone that you were outraged? Were you ringing the bell to be heard?
I think all of us at the health department level, at the local health department level, have been asking to receive more vaccine. And understandably, on the federal level at this point, it is a factor of demand exceeding supply, and the manufacturing and distribution have not really been scaled to population size, and that has severely impacted the current rate of rollout. So that must be mentioned, and that is on the federal level. However, on the state level, it was very counterintuitive that the longstanding pandemic response infrastructure that had the local health departments in the center of mass vaccination and pandemic response plans was not utilized to the point that we are used to.
Well, the good news is that you were able to quickly turn those 800 doses around and get them into people's arms right away. How did your rollout go?
Yes, and the rollout was phenomenal. It went spectacularly well, which is exactly a testament to the fact that local health departments are prepared for this. We were trained for this specifically for pandemic response and mass vaccination. The Orange County, New York Department of Health received 800 doses of vaccine Tuesday morning. And in less than 24 hours, we organized over 100 amazing volunteers and staff who by close of business day Wednesday, the next day, vaccinated 800 of the New York State Vaccination Program Phase 1A residents. So we utilized every single drop of the allocated vaccine.
Well, thank you to those volunteers. But now what? You've got those 800 delivered, but you have 380,000 people living in Orange County, New York. And do you think you have another waiting game on your hands?
So it still remains unclear how frequently we will continue to get vaccine and what the allocations would look like. And of course, it's important to really follow the infrastructure that was in place all along. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars training local health departments specifically for this moment in time for pandemic response and mass vaccinations. We've submitted plans annually. We've had annual drills. New York State has spent quite a bit of money training local health departments in emergency response and the use of data systems. So it's imperative to really utilize that.
I'm sure you've seen pictures of senior citizens lining up and camping outside waiting to get shots in different places around the country. Do you suspect that could be a problem where you are? And if not, what do you think about the fact that it's come to this?
I think, again, it's really important to have a well-coordinated response, and depending on the amount of vaccine that is allocated and that is available, we would coordinate and collaborate with our local partners. But as far as administration goes, there's more to vaccine administration than just the injection itself. It's very important to consider the coordination of the allocation. So regionally, we're really addressing those susceptible, vulnerable, medically fragile populations. And we're really considering health equity and addressing any disparities that exist. And I think the local health departments, again, could really provide insight as the subject matter experts.
Well, doctor, thank you for your insight. And just quickly, have you taken the vaccine yet?
Not just as yet, because I would like for all of our frontliners and staff to really obtain it first.
Yeah. Dr. Irina Gelman, Health Commissioner for Orange County, New York, which just got its first 800 doses of the coronavirus vaccine this week, 3 weeks after they were approved by the federal government. Dr. Gelman, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. Stay well.
Well, rural communities in small towns and parts of the West have long been strongholds for President Donald Trump and voted overwhelmingly for him in the last election. Nate Hedgie from the Mountain West News Bureau checked in with a handful of voters in the region to see how they're reacting to this week's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
Last summer, I met with Ben Bardo outside the small town of Du Bois, Wyoming. He's a huge Trump supporter, and we were having a conversation about where he thought America was headed.
Revolution?
You think so?
I do. I think it's headed there.
Flash forward to the violent scenes at the U.S. Capitol. I checked in with Bardo again to get his take, and he says we're inching even closer to revolution.
Just hasn't started yet.
And the violence at the Capitol? He believes the loose anti-fascist movement Antifa was there, causing trouble.
It was orchestrated. They will do anything to cause chaos and disrupt, and they had to figure out a way to turn the whole world against Trump supporters.
Let's be clear. There is no credible evidence to back that up. But like a lot of his information, Bardo heard that on Fox News.
Now, there were likely not all Trump supporters, and there are some reports that Antifa sympathizers may have been sprinkled throughout the crowd. We'll have more
this
on that later.
This is where we are. Our country is awash in disinformation. People get to choose their own reality. And in Bardo's reality, with the Democrats taking control, more violence is coming.
If it gets to that point where they come to try and take our weapons, if they want to stifle us any further than they already are with the free speech, it's going to happen.
Hundreds of miles north in Montana's conservative Bitterroot Valley, Marine Corps veteran Taylan Lang says he's also worried about more violence. He tells me he was out shooting his rifle at a gun range recently.
And, the guy who was sitting next to me was talking about, this is all very important because we have the revolution that's coming and, everybody has to be prepared to, fight the government and the liberals and, socialism and all this kind of stuff.
Here's the thing, though. Lang is one of those liberals. And when he saw what happened at the U.S. Capitol, he says he wept for his country.
I mean, we had this whole segment of people who truly believe that they're patriots. And they're in that position and they're storming the halls of the Capitol because they believe falsehoods.
Those falsehoods have crept into small towns and rural communities across the West, helping fuel distrust in everything from public health measures to November's election. But Maddie Bishop says there's something else at play here, too. Bishop lives in Libby, Montana. He voted Libertarian in the last election, but says a lot of his friends are Trump supporters.
Even as the images from the Capitol were being
broadcast, they're justifying what's happening, that we've reached a breaking point. The system is broken. They feel betrayed. And to be honest, I think rural America has been betrayed, but that's happened over the course of the last 20 years.
He says many of his neighbors are angry and desperate because, in their minds, their traditional way of life has been taken away. Logging and mining contracts have dried up. Small businesses struggle to compete against big companies like Walmart and Amazon. America's wealth gap, after all, has doubled over the past three decades, and Trump tapped into some of that anger. Still, Bishop doesn't understand why some of his friends followed Trump down the rabbit hole and don't believe in facts anymore.
Right now, what you call a fact, another person disputes and says, well, that's not true because I saw a YouTube video that my cousin posted and I trust him more than I trust this media guy.
A democracy without facts is like a truck without oil. The engine seizes. It can't run. That's what worries Julie Weitz. She lives in Sheridan, Wyoming. She was shocked by what happened at the Capitol. But she says in Sheridan, there's also two realities.
I find myself trying to explain or justify something that didn't really happen, that I can clearly see that person believes, but it isn't true. And so then I just feel like throwing my hands up in the air because they can't be reached.
For Here and Now, I'm Nate Hedgie in Missoula, Montana.
Taiwan has had remarkable success staving off the coronavirus pandemic compared to other countries. The island is made up of 24 million people, but has only reported 7 deaths. A big part of Taiwan's strategy is that it has essentially sealed itself off from the rest of the world. KPCC's Josie Huang traveled there from L.A. to visit family, and she joins us now with more on the country's protocols. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
Well, Josie, like a true journalist, you're working even on a personal trip. Taiwan and other countries around the Asia Pacific have imposed pretty strict quarantine requirements. You're more than halfway through your quarantine in Taipei. What have you observed so far?
So you see people wearing masks everywhere, but outside of that, I'd say life is pretty unchanged since the pandemic. I saw that when I was in my cab going from the airport. And I remember seeing people eating inside restaurants. I saw kids being dropped off at school. People were going to work in office buildings. And a big reason why COVID is being contained here is that there are very tight entry restrictions. And when travelers do come, including Taiwanese citizens, they have to be under strict quarantine for 2 weeks.
Well, what were the protocols when you landed at the airport?
Well, I should mention, even before I could board the plane to Taiwan, I had to present a negative COVID test. And after I landed in Taiwan and was walking to immigration, then at that point, I was intercepted by airport workers who asked if you have a cell phone. Now, I do have my cell phone, but I don't get service in Taiwan. So I was told I needed to buy a SIM card. This is so they can location track me to make sure I'm sticking to quarantine. And there's fines of up to $35,000 US if you violate quarantine, and they will come looking for you. So I definitely wanted to get my SIM card thing squared away. And then I was able to make it through immigration. I found a cab. And, you know, this was very memorable. The driver sanitized me and my luggage by spraying us with an alcohol mix. And then he let me get into his car.
He sanitized you and your luggage.
Yes, it was like a cool mist.
This is pretty incredible, but what happens, I'm really interested in going through every step with you. What happens when you actually get to your hotel?
Yeah, this was very interesting. My hotel is a special quarantine hotel. It's one of more than 130 hotels that are taking part in this quarantine program. And once I was in my room, I found virtually everything I would need. But, you know, really the most important thing that was given to me was a thermometer. So what I do every day now is I take my temperature twice a day and I have to report it to the hotel. So they're definitely like not playing around.
Can you not leave your room at all?
Absolutely not. No.
You mentioned the government in Taiwan is keeping tabs on you, as you said, throughout your quarantine. What has it been like? You've received
these texts? What's your temperature? What are some other things that you've experienced?
So I've also gotten a couple phone calls from live people asking how I was doing. And I was really struck by my last call where the woman who called me, she asked me how my mental health was. And, you know, I told her, I can't say I'm loving quarantine, but then she added, it's all about looking out for each other and that they, which I presume is the government, cares about me. So, Tanya, there's this real team spirit thing in Taiwan that I've noticed. And I should mention that even the trash trucks are part of this. You know, since the pandemic, the trucks also play a recorded message about COVID. And I was able to make a recording for you because there's this trash truck that stops beneath my hotel window almost every day. So what we're hearing, Tanya, is a reminder to socially distance, also to wear a mask in public spaces and to wash your hands with soap. There's also mention of a hotline you can call if you're having any of the symptoms.
This is amazing. It almost feels too good to be true that everything like this could go off without a hitch. But we're talking about an entirely different country than the United States, which I'm assuming for you, you must be feeling a lot of emotions around the stark differences between where you left, which is Los Angeles, currently the worst epicenter for COVID-19 in all of the U.S., and then where you are right now in Taiwan, as you're seeing so many restrictions put in place to keep this virus down.
Oh, man, it's made me really sad, actually. It's been very surreal reading about all the hurt and suffering in L.A. while I'm in this country where COVID is under control. I really feel like I'm in another dimension. You know, quarantine's keeping me from seeing my family in Taiwan, and that's been hard. But I understand the reasoning behind it, because if Taiwan wants to spare its citizens the pain of what's happening with the pandemic in the U.S., I support that. So I respect the quarantine.
Josie Huang is a reporter for KPCC in Los Angeles, who is currently quarantining in Taiwan. Josie, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us, and stay safe.
Thank you, Tanya.
And we have photos of life under quarantine in Taiwan. Just go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.